You're listening to RTE Lyric Live from the West Cork Chamber Music Festival.
Modernity brings many things to the table when a composer begins his or her work. And by modernity, I guess I'm talking about the 20th and 21st centuries, our modern times. To begin with, one thing placed upon the table, strangely enough, is a legacy. For modernity can't be new without at least a nod or an oblique reference to the old. For something to become outmoded, we have to first be aware of it when it was à la mode, before we recognise and acknowledge its replacement. Thus, our knowledge of music can only be complete if we're aware of form, structure, and a heritage before all that can be overturned or challenged. But what does this have to do with names? Well, almost everything. The 18th and 19th centuries were a time of codification, in music as in everything else. Living things were analysed and given precise names that identified their place in a phantasmagoria of existence. The earth was mapped, the heavens too, and even the inner workings of mind and body were examined in the greatest of detail. All this intense analysis, philosophical, scientific and conjectural, meant that by the end of the 19th century, there was a label appended to almost everything in the known world, and a formula that could lead even the layperson to an understanding of what appeared before his or her eyes. Music was not immune to this rigour. In a relatively swift transition during the late 16th and mid-17th centuries, prosaic descriptions of keyboard pieces, for example, were done away with. In the 15th or 16th century, a title such as Voluntary for My Lady Neville told us little, if anything, about the music, except that the composer, in this case William Byrd, wrote it for the Lady Neville and that it was likely to sound like a processional work. Within a matter of two decades, such a composition would transmogrify into a pavan in G major, conveying to English-speaking and non-English-speaking alike that this piece was to be played slowly, as the pavan was a slow dance, that the predominating tonal centre would be G, with its mood likely to be light or even merry, as a major key would indicate. And composers seem to like this stiffness of language. Music deals in transient sound, but the definitive titles arrived at by the late 18th century gave to composers and musicologists alike some semblance of consistency. A sonata is structured just so, a symphony this way, a concerto, well, like that. However, this doesn't mean that there weren't efforts made to name works in the 17th or 18th or 19th centuries. Music catalogues are heavy with titles inextricably linked to compositions, and such works are often found more easily under these assumed names than under their more precise opus numbers. Handel may have composed a famous piece to be played on a journey down the Thames for the enjoyment of George I, but he would never have known this piece as the Water Music. So who's responsible, guilty even, for replacing the perfectly serviceable Suite in F Major with a prose title, and a limp one at that? Well, the market. Publishers need to sell as well as publish, and how better to attract buyers to the stall than with a catchy and ideally accurate description of what will be heard? Naming, or as we might call it now, branding, is initially what the codification of music terminology was all about. A musical form was created, and the words used themselves were simple. Sonata, a piece played. Cantata, a sung piece. Opera, a work. Symphony, an agreement in sound. I could go on. Over time, and with a degree of discipline, these terms were accepted as the appropriate name of a form, and within them held the rules for each composition of that name. A symphony should have four movements, a concerto, three, a French opera, five acts. This meant that impresari, players, concertgoers and patrons could all agree on what they were commissioning, or writing, or paying a ticket to, or allowing their name to appear on a dedication page of. Caveat emptor still applied, for there were pirates out there then as now, but what was on the lid of the tin almost always guaranteed the content. And so we arrive at another way for the publisher to attract his customers. If the name of a prince or count were to appear on the composer's dedication page, this was like a gold medal affixed to the label on that bottle of wine you were not so certain of. See, southeastern Australia on a label, well, that could mean anything. But a gold medal from the Adelaide Show? That must count for something, surely. Well, in truth, in wine and music, not always. However, for Beethoven, it probably was of some use in terms of sales and subscriptions that his Opus 59 string quartets were also named, by dedication, the Razumovsky Quartets. Russian ambassador to the Habsburg court in Vienna, Andrei, Count Razumovsky, alongside his Czech brother-in-law, Franz, Prince Lobkowitz, were great patrons of the 30-something Beethoven. From 1800 to 1815, their direct interest, socially and financially, in the headstrong contemporary was of immense importance, given that it coincided not only with the composer's most fruitful period, but also the significant decline in his hearing. Beethoven didn't start out writing these string quartets in 1806 with a name in mind, or already appended. Razumovsky's commission was for the form alone, with a little Russian theme worked in if the maestro would be so obliging. Beethoven has suffered, along with his elders Haydn and Mozart, in having names attached to a host of his pieces that he himself never gave them. All three composers seemed more than content to leave their works in the realm of the arid terminology of classical music. The Moonlight Sonata was, for Beethoven, his 14th piano sonata, Opus 27, No. 2, and nothing more. However, a notorious namer was only a decade away. Franz Liszt seemed almost the antithesis of formality in nomenclature, with a host of his piano works eschewing traditional categories and taking names. Année de pèlerinage, Totentanz, Ammonie poétique et religieuse. This was the start of a trend that began to increasingly link music to its audiences via words as well as notes. And by the time we enter the 20th century, it seems the bulk of composers are wearing their hearts much more on their sleeves. Works no longer stand or fall on their content alone. They are given names and guides and sometimes inordinately large signposts so that even the dullest of minds would quickly get the message at the heart of the music. In 1885, Brahms was perfectly happy to call his fourth and last symphony his, well, Symphony No. 4. Yet a year beforehand, a young Gustav Mahler had begun his Symphony No. 1, tentatively named Titan. This naming fetish was beginning to take hold as composers encountered the waning years of the 19th century. Leo Szynarczyk seemed to anticipate a time when prose titles would supplant sonata and concerto, the best example of this being his Intimate Letters Quartet we've just heard. Though this work was a commission, the Bohemian Quartet had not asked for a title, nor was it given to the work by a salacious publisher. No, the naming was Janáček's, and spoke of his love, largely unrequited, for his late-period muse, Kamila Sturzlova. He died the same year the quartet was completed and performed, 1928, missing its premiere by exactly 30 days. And since that year, the growth in names consciously connected to a musical composition has been astonishing. One might even venture excessive. Let me take a little time in quoting from a program note prepared for the commissioned work, Voices. The note is by its Philadelphia-based composer, Jennifer Higdon. The 1993 string quartet, she informs us, is the telling of three different images. The first, Blitz, carries a tremendous amount of relentless, frenzied energy, a high level of intensity, always on the verge of explosion. The second, Soft Enlacing, carries a much more vague meaning and is a calming contrast from the first movement. It may be very much like a walk through the house in the middle of the night. While the floor feels solid underfoot, the rest of the world, to the eyes and ears, seems to be moving shadows. It may also be a gentle hug or the warm emotional embrace of a loved one. Again, its image is not meant to be clear-cut and depends upon the listener's viewing. The final movement, Grace, is the calmest and carries the most possible number of meanings. The giving of thanks at a meal, the grace seen in behaviour or in a personality, the grace of movement, the bestowing of oneself unto others, the quiet presence that exists in a being's soul. Born in 1962, Higdon is one of the most performed composers in the US, though the reception of her music outside of America has been more mixed. However, my concern with her is not as a composer, but as a writer. What use is there in a program note that crosses the T's and dots the I's for its listeners? Where is music's intrinsic value, if not in its essential vagueness? That quality which is immediately lost once the composer opens his or her mouth to explain what is about to be heard. Art requires the artist to be silent, while the created work, if it's good enough, will be eloquent beyond measure and at every instance throughout its life. Another member of the Name Everything group, though operating in a different compositional world, is the Australian Brett Dean. Unchallenged is the high importance of Dean's work as both a performer, for 14 years he was a Berlin Philharmonic violist, and as a leader in music education at home. Until 2010, he was artistic director of the Australian National Academy of Music in my hometown of Melbourne. His music is skillful and compelling, as we heard in the 1996 work for solo viola, Intimate Decisions. And he is an original voice on the national and international scene. Yet only one piece that I know of amongst all of Dean's compositions takes what we might best call a traditional name, his Viola Concerto from 2004. The rest of his non-text-based pieces go by such titles as 12 Angry Men for 12 cellos, an orchestral work, Dispersal, and The Lost Art of Letter Writing, which is actually a concerto for violin. In no way do I want to denigrate his works or suggest that Dean is at a loss for notes and therefore must, of necessity, resort to words. But it is of interest that we've reverted to the naming of compositions, a tradition begun in the earliest days of Western classical music, whilst jettisoning the old codes and catalogues so familiar, so unambiguous, and so liberating in their structure. These dry guides allowed each listener a glimpse, a sketch, if you will, of what was to be heard. But what it meant, that was and is another thing altogether. What's in a name? To my mind, often not as much as a composer may intend, though I suspect some of them hope for a greater understanding, perhaps even a greater acceptance of their music, if only they can explain why it sounds as it does. Herein lies the problem. Although Beethoven himself called his Symphony No. 6 Pastoral, there is no difficulty for the listener to make the connection with the fields, country taverns, and woodland birds beyond Vienna and Beethoven's music. The title was little more than a confirmation to the listener. Yes, what you think you are hearing, you are hearing. By contrast, contemporary music is filled, even overburdened, with technical complexities and musical gestures beyond the understanding of the generalist listener, and sometimes even the noble expert. Contemporary music now requires, even demands, us to possess more knowledge or higher levels of oral sophistication. Yet this is at a time when society's musical literacy is probably at its lowest point in 200 or 300 years. The once clear terminology, sonata, symphony, opera, now represents a barrier to understanding when once they were sure portals. Composers can no longer rely on such terms to bring the listener to the gate, much less persuade them to enter in. And so we have Brett Dean and Jennifer Higdon and a host of greater and lesser composers all searching to create a new paradigm, a paradigm where a title triggers interest and unsubtle signposts point out the only safe and possible route to understanding. And now, what once was contained within a genre or form needs to be discussed in an essay, with music's persuasive notes needing the help of crib sheets and word maps. What's in a name? Not so much good as you might imagine where present-day music is concerned. For though the written word is not the composer's first language, composers now are forced to announce the intent of their works in text, subverting music's natural advantage, its ability to transcend description. What once began as a suggestion or mere hint at what lay beneath seems in our time to be writ large upon a metaphorical banner or neon sign, and more than just subtlety is lost. Music needs fewer words. It's time to leave off the names. The rose smells just as sweet when we let it bloom, allow its perfume to envelop us, as the strongest and best of them will. We do not need to know its name to recognize its power.